number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Welcome to The Stuart Knight Show, where interesting, intriguing, and exciting people engage in unscripted exchanges of ideas, stories, and perspectives. It's not an interview. It's a powerful conversation.
Hey there, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to The Stuart Knight Show. This week, I'm talking to my new friend, Brian Franklin. Brian is one of America's best leadership coaches and has helped seven companies reach $1 billion in either revenue or valuation. He is a big thinker and has many insights that will change the way you see the world. During this powerful conversation, we talk about all kinds of things, such as love, leadership, and the things that children can teach us. How's that for a powerful conversation? Here we go. Well, hello there, Brian Franklin. Thank you for being on the show today.
Hello, and Stuart, it's great to meet you. And conversation is one of my favorite arts and favorite playtime activities, so I'm super excited.
Excellent, excellent. And you know, I think that you led right into that nicely, is that for anyone listening right now, what I really like about this conversation is that this is the first time I've had somebody on the show where I haven't known them. And you and I have now literally, I mean, known each other for 5 minutes. And I think that's really great for people to understand that, you know, whether it's an individual you've known for a long time or known for a short period of time, if two people are willing to engage in a powerful conversation, it can go anywhere. So let's see where it goes. So I know nothing about you. I think you pretty much know very little about me. What are you excited about these days?
Well, I'm excited about, so much. I'm excited about a major shift of hierarchy, is what I'll call it.
Okay.
In values for my wife, Jennifer, and I together. First thing you got to know about Jennifer and I is we're partners in everything. So we partner in business, we partner in life, we partner in every decision. So when I say my wife, some people think of like, the person at home that waits for you when you get home, or some people think of, you know, two independent careers that coincide, you know, that have the kids in common or something. But for me, when I say that, I really mean my spiritual teacher, my life companion, and the other set of eyes and ears looking out into the world and continually asking the question, how can we contribute the most? So we've had a pretty major shift from self-care, health, and what I'll call spaciousness, kind of a feeling of spaciousness, from those things being in the category really of luxury that you earn once you've put in your good work or your, you know, successful project.
Right.
In other words, I earned a lot of money. I did a successful program. We did a launch. We had a great month. So now we can, quote, afford to take a 10-day silent meditation retreat or the opposite. I'm so busy that I don't have time to prepare really high quality food. So I'm just going to have kind of like a taco,
right?
You know, and just power through because we don't have time. So we've lived our whole lives that way, and I don't think we're alone. I think it's a common way to have it. And I noticed that the people I admire most actually view their own mind and their consciousness as the source of everything that they create, and they view their bodies as the source, or at least the seat of that consciousness. So taking care of their bodies, getting enough sleep, eating high quality food, having mental spaciousness for them isn't the luxury that you get as a reward for succeeding, but it's the thing that you draw on. And so when something starts to go sideways on a project, instead of pulling an all-nighter, they get more sleep and focus more on diet.
Right. It's the classic, you know, scenario of pay yourself first so that, yeah, you know, you can create the environment or the level of success that you want to have. Now, I'm interested, I would imagine that most people listening to this would feel the same way that I do, which is when a power couple such as yourselves have been working really hard and you've done well, and now it's time to give yourself a bit of a pat in the back and a bit of a break. And most people wouldn't head to a 10-day silent retreat together. What's that about?
I should clarify, she actually did the silent retreat, and I stayed home and wrote music for that period of time and worked. But I'll tell you what it's about. So the form of meditation is called Vipassana. Mm-hmm. And it has many, many layers. But the first is that Every time you interact with someone, nod at them, wink at them, have a conversation, you are dissipating energy. So I don't know if you imagine like standing very close to someone, let's say in an elevator, but facing each other and not saying anything, there's a lot of energy that gets created, and you have to expend that energy or dissipate it through like nodding or winking or laughing or talking. And part of the silent meditation, it's not just that you don't speak, but it's what's called noble silence, which is means you don't acknowledge the presence of any other human. There's no winking, nodding, waving, you know, clasping of hands, touching, or anything.
Right.
And that's for 10 days. So during that 10 days, all that energy that normally gets dissipated is stored up and creates almost an internal pressure. And that internal pressure gets more and more and more, and eventually gets hot enough to purify, clarify, and it's almost like a self-cleaning oven, and it has an effect of cleaning out your consciousness.
Oh, that's amazing. I've actually, you know, I've known people who've taken this 10-day retreat, and they've always come back with the same stories. It seems to be the beginning was hell. You know, thought they weren't going to get through it, had many thoughts of leaving by day two or day three. Of course, it started getting better as time went on. And even the thoughts going into it was like, you know, how can I go 10 days and not speak? And then the final thought that always comes from people's mouths and minds when I speak to them at the end of this is just how absolutely mind-blowing the experience was, and how, like you said, cleansing the experience was. I guess the idea was that there were certain thoughts that came up for them that they never in a million years even knew existed or expected to come up. And I like the way you've said it, that that becomes a self-cleaning oven.
Yeah. And when all of that stuff gets burned out, what's left is a direct experience of reality, which is available at any moment, but most of us don't have it. Most of us relate to our ideas of what we are experiencing more than what we're actually experiencing.
Right.
There's that buffer layer between reality and us of interpretation. And without all the pollutants of bad food, externalized harm, one of the reasons they ask you not to speak is because they want you to be in integrity. And if they figure if you're talking, you're lying. So, you know, because someone might say, how are you doing? And you might say, fine. So it's just a profound amount of integrity, for a profound degree of integrity. And in that space, you can start to experience the nature of reality itself within your own body. And then you start to recognize, wow, you know, what does it mean to be you? What are you really capable of? Not in terms of the idea of, oh, I can accomplish this task or achieve this thing, but in terms of your, you know, your just connectedness to what you might call God or Source,
right?
And the lack of distinction or the lack of individuation between all of us as humans, all living things, and all matter, in fact.
You know, I always remember the very first time I was ever introduced to the ideas surrounding spirituality and the ego and what we identify with being real. And one of the things that I've always loved is that exercise where you say to yourself, close your eyes, and you say, who am I? And then the brain comes up and says, well, I am Stuart Knight, and I'm a professional speaker, and I'm an author. And then the voice then comes back and says, well, who said that? And then I say, well, you know, but Stuart Knight did. He's a guy that grew up in a small town. And eventually you keep asking yourself the question, well, who is that? And then who is that? And eventually you come to this place where, of course, the brain, because it can't really be the true thing that it is. It really is just essentially a tool. And the brain gets to that place where it's like, oh, God, I don't necessarily know. And I would imagine if you are quiet long enough that eventually you'll get much closer to that true sense of self.
Yes.
Which to me you could probably, you know, really use this and label this as one of the biggest problems that we're facing in the world today, is that every decision that every person makes is based on who they think they are and who they think they need to protect. But when it really comes right down to it, the person that they truly are probably wouldn't care about whether or not there were dividing lines between countries, or wouldn't care whether or not, you know, somebody had more gold or oil or something that they want. And I can imagine it would have a huge impact on the world. I mean, do you see it as being one of the biggest problems that we face as a species?
Yeah, or biggest opportunities, depending on your glass half full, half empty.
Sure.
Yes, absolutely. I, you know, everything that comes after the question, what do you want? If I say, hey, what do you want? Whatever comes up for you, and I ask that, is very, very likely to be a compensation or an anesthetic for a deeper sense of pain, which comes from a lack of relationship with self. So if you have even just a moment of really relationship to self, not the identity that you were talking about with the name and the position and where, you know, the history and the, you know, and the resume, but who's the one that's generating all that stuff? And if you have even a moment of real relationship with self, then your need for achievement, for belonging, for money, for, you know, to get that girl's number or whatever, will actually dissipate. Those perceived needs or perceived wants are usually, it's like there's an agreement underneath there that says, well, since I can't have the relationship I really want, which is relationship to self, then this will kind of make up for it.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I just went through an interesting experience over the last few weeks where there's a particular client that I've been working with that I really want to do business with, and I really want them to choose me. And they have now chosen me. But I believe that one of the reasons why I was chosen was because halfway through the process, I decided to have a conversation with myself where I said, look, Stuart, you are attaching so much importance to getting this particular contract. You know, you are making it as if it, you know, I will be more important, or that the extra money that I will make will be, you know, beneficial for all these other reasons. And I turned it into something of greater importance than what it is. And I don't know why these were the words, but at the end of it, I kept coming out of it when I finally had this conversation with myself where I said, you know what, Stuart, there's no more room for fear today. And when I said that, it automatically allowed me to be closer to the true person who I was, which was to really share the benefits that I can bring to the program. And I believe that resonated with some sort of universal level with the people in that room. And instantly when I made that shift in myself, it just seemed to make it so much easier to get the contract.
Yeah, totally. It's funny, you mentioned that making it more important. I'm an electronic music producer. I make music, and I make music dedicated to the relationships of epic couples in my community. So it, kind of love relationships that I'm inspired by, I tell their story electronically.
Wow.
And the name that I go by is called Nimite. It's, if you like go to SoundCloud or something and you search for Nimite, N-I-M-I-T-A-E, that's me. But Nimite is an acronym. And it stands for what I used for years as basically my only moral compass, which was to not do that thing you were just talking about, which is make something more important than it should be. And the acronym stands for nothing is more important than anything else.
Right.
And that's a good reminder. You know, death is not more important than life. Life is not more important than death. Universally speaking, all things that exist have equal right to existence. And therefore have the same importance, which means any kind of differential preference you feel is generated by you. It doesn't exist outside of you. And if it's getting in your way, like, for example, you know, causing you to act self-consciously and therefore not as effectively, then just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things, as Kabir says in his famous poem. So.
I love that. I love that. And what a great... you know, name to have for yourself as far as being a music producer. And so what's that process like then? When you say that you basically, you are inspired by two people's story of love, and then you translate that into music, how does that process work for you?
Well, it starts by noticing the couple. And, you know, I've done seven, I think, of these tracks so far. There'll be a total of nine, and they'll be on album at some point in the future once those are done. But the idea is I notice the couple, and I notice how fabulously amazing they work together. And usually I notice that I wouldn't work in that couple. In other words, they've created a totally custom fit way of relating, which works perfectly for the two of them, and is not universal. It's just how they love, and it's perfect. And I sit in admiration of that and experience it, and then start to ask them about, you know, what were they like before they met? What was it like to be one piece of this puzzle but without the other piece? And how were you out of balance prior to your union?
Okay.
And then what was the process of meeting? How did you learn from each other? And how did you put each other in balance? How did you create a homeostasis around the, you know, the values that are important to you through your relationship? And so, for example, I did one for Annie and Eben, by the way.
Okay.
Annie Lala, who introduced us, mm-hmm. and her husband, Eben Pagan. And I met them before they met each other. And at the time, Annie was primarily an emotion-driven person. So she honored and heralded emotion as the king, and then the mind was meant to serve emotion, the body meant to serve emotion. But, you know, she's the self-proclaimed avatar of love, right? So just she's all about love and true love. And so the mind for her was something to transcend in order to be in a more pure emotion state. Like your ideas of the mind get in the way of your love. And so you shed those and you can love more purely. That was her kind of frame.
Okay.
And she met Eben, who viewed emotion, he called it the tyranny of emotion. He viewed emotion as what comes up to interrupt your mind's normal running capacity. So our mind have the ability to solve any problem unless we're triggered and our emotion comes up and then kind of takes options off the table for our mind until it cannot function anymore. And so his mission was to use the mind's ability to model and understand, and therefore transcend emotion so that you could escape the tyranny of emotion. That was his worldview. And then they met and fell in love.
Right. Okay. So it's essentially they were coming from almost polar opposites.
Exactly. And so some of, you know, that showed up in the way they would fight with each other. It showed up in the way that they would make beauty together. And the way they would learn from each other. And, you know, they each kind of backed off of their more polar view and created a more symbiotic view of mind and heart. And so I wrote a song called The Guru and the Avatar. And it starts out with really exploring mind. And it's, you know, some music you listen to and you can kind of feel your mind wrap around the music.
Right.
And maybe you want to tap your foot, but your emotion or your body is not really involved. It's more like, you know, wow, that's really intellectually interesting music. So it starts out like that and then breaks into a section which is just pure heart. All emotion with no structure.
Oh, okay.
And then combines the two for an even more beautiful and transcendent outcome.
So now a lot of people listening to this, I would imagine, first of all, if they haven't found themselves in that lucky or unlucky or I don't know what word you would use, but in that situation where they've experienced the kind of love that you're describing between Annie and Eben, do you find that, you know, was Annie and Eben, do you feel, or were they just lucky to, you know, have found, you know, perfect matches to their yin and to their yang? Or was it a case where on some level, let's say Annie, if you choose her, acting emotionally, did she attract someone who was operating from the mind?
Well, because we, you talked about, I'm going to answer the question with a question because you're encouraging me to ask you questions. So I want to know, what's your view on love? And are you in love? And do you think that Annie and Eben were just lucky?
You know, it's so interesting. I've obviously given a lot of thought to life and love being probably one of the biggest components of it is something that I've given a lot of consideration to. And one thing that has really popped up for me more than ever. See, I used to very much subscribe to the fairy tale, which was I would get on a plane one day after, you know, falling, like, or let's say I see a woman in line at Starbucks and I think she's just the most beautiful thing ever and we catch eyes but we don't say anything to her. And then I get on the plane and lo and behold, she's sitting next to me. And then by the end of the flight, we're engaged, you know? That was the idea of love that I had before and that would be the way it would unfold. But all of a sudden, somewhere along the line, the idea of partnership really started resonating with me. And before, up until that point when someone would say, this is my partner, for me it always seemed to be a term that was more often than not held for the gay world. And yep. and that, you know, gay people would say, oh, this is my partner, which I thought, right. oh, yeah, what a great term to use if they don't want to use boyfriend or girlfriend. And then of course, it started moving into more of a heterosexual world, and I thought it was kind of odd. But it's now at a point in my life where I finally seem to get it through the relationships I've gone through, where I realize two people choose to be in a partnership with each other, and they choose to do the work that they need to do in order to be their best self that they can bring to the relationship, and thus at the same time learn the most that they can from their partner, and then at the end create, as you were saying before, that union, and a union that transcends everything. And that's something that I really believe in now. However, the question is still, it's still kind of on the top of my mind, which is, you know, if I understand that, I still have to do that work in order to find that individual. I mean, anyone who knows her and anyone who knows Eben knows that the two of them are people who don't just stay at home in their apartment. You know, they go out to things like Burning Man. They go to conferences. They do work where they're out socially, especially someone like Annie. And I believe that if someone has done the work on themselves, they then increase the chances of themselves finding that partner, that yin to the yang or whatever you want to look at it. Significantly by doing that work and by getting out there. So I don't know. I don't think that Annie and Eben were lucky. I think that the two of them continuously threw themselves out there. And while the time leading up to them meeting, they were continuously doing self-work. And I believe that when they met, they were ready for each other. And if they had not done that self-work, or one of them was doing it and the other one wasn't, they may not have had this union. So I don't believe from my end, luck had anything to do with it.
Yeah, I'm with you on the not lucky for sure. Although it sounds funny, you guys were not lucky.
But, yeah.
When you met, whoa, no luck. I wanted to say more about the quote doing the work. Jennifer, one of my first fights with my wife, Jennifer, you know, we're like, I don't know, 4 months into dating, the honeymoon period traditionally had defined. Was starting to see, you could see through it in certain areas, you know, and we're like, meh, 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 meh. And kind of at a moment of frustration, I said, look, I'm really working hard on this. Okay. Like, can you give me some freaking credit?
Right.
And she said, you know, yuck, work. I don't want to be your work. You have to work on this, whether you're with me or not. It's your issue. It's a privilege to have me present while you do it.
Wow, what a great way of putting it. I really like that.
And she's right. She's right. I'm sure you've had the experience of having an issue and then kind of blame it on the other person. You break up with them and then you have someone else. You start dating someone else and a few months later you get the same issue.
Right.
Or some version of it, right? It's because it's you. It's not them. And that's why you're triggered. Because you. So the work is really your work. Whether or not you're with the other person, just the opportunity of having a beautiful relationship presents you with all the ways you haven't done your work yet and gives you an awesome, sexy partner to like collaborate with on doing that stuff. So it's really a privilege to be in partnership, I think.
It's funny because I've always loved that thing that, and I said it to her when I was speaking to her recently when Annie, you know, who is a love coach, of course, in New York, she said to me, you know, relationships are the greatest area to do work and to, but also learn those parts about yourself that are most ugly. And that's the reason why most people leave them.
Yeah, right.
They don't want to be in a situation where they have to dig deep and go, God, in relationship to this, who am I? Am I a jealous person? Am I an angry person? Am I somebody who is immature in certain areas of my life? And you know, it's easier to just break up with a person than it is to answer those questions. Whereas, right. Of course, if people do that, they unfortunately never really get to tap into the most beautiful components of life, which is to really discover who you are.
Yeah, yeah.
So now, is something that you've? What's probably now? First of all, how long have you been married for?
I think we've been married 2 years. It's hard to tell, but we've been together 6, and our wedding was just an epic event for our community, but didn't really represent a turning point in our relationship. It was more of an acknowledgement it was already so. So I think it's 2 years, though.
Okay. And so in that 2 years, or I should say in the last 6 years, what would be one of the biggest things, or the biggest thing that comes to mind straight away that you've learned from your wife?
That's, everything about who I am and who I could be is the answer.
So how have you most, like, in that respect then, before you met Jennifer, what would you say, if let's say I knew you beforehand and I hadn't seen you for 6 years and I bump into you, what would be perhaps one thing I would notice as your friend that you never possessed before?
Well, one thing is that the most common first impression that people have of me before I met Jennifer was that I was very smart. There was something to me which was interesting, but they weren't sure if they could trust me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I continually had the experience where I was earnest and not believed.
Okay.
And, you know, I didn't think the fact that I was lying about other things to other people had anything to do with why the person I'm talking to, you know, they don't know that. They don't know my history. They don't know this other context or this other relationship. If I'm dishonest in my relationship but honest at work, why would the people at work not trust me? I didn't understand.
Interesting. Okay.
And now I have the profound opposite impact on most people, where they instantly understand my authenticity and can trust. They feel safe with me because they know that my agenda is explicit and not hidden.
That's interesting. I've never thought about that, because I sometimes one of my favorite things to hear at the end of my presentations is that people say, "God, you know what?" And I guess they've just had bad experiences with other speakers, but they'll say, "Wow, you know, you really come across like you believe what you're saying." Which to me is so funny. It's so funny because considering the fact that I'm like, well, I didn't dedicate my life to this because I didn't believe it. And so yet, but I have had on the opposite end of the spectrum certain moments where people have just, for whatever reason, I could be at a birthday party or a wedding and I'm chatting with someone. And once in a while, I've had people say, "Oh, I don't know if I believe you. I don't believe that someone like you could be that energetic or that enthusiastic about a particular subject. It just doesn't exist." And in many cases, it could be just something that they're dealing with themselves. But I have experienced that on some level.
That's what we like to tell ourselves. It's probably them. Also, the other piece of the puzzle is the regard you have for them. So I used to assume that when I would meet someone that I was probably smarter than them.
Okay.
And so I would be listening to what they were saying, not as a student of whatever they, you know, that not with the expectation that I would find something new in there that would be forever change me irrevocably. But listening for where I could impart some of my wisdom to them and make a difference, because I wanted an intimacy for me was achieved by making a difference for someone. So if I wanted to have more intimacy with you, I would give more to you. That would be my frame.
Okay.
And lots of people liked that a lot. It was, you know, it was not a bankrupt strategy, but it also wasn't relating to intimacy very much. And I had some people who would say, you know, I just want intimacy. I don't want, and by intimacy here, I don't mean sex. I mean that sense of being truly close to someone. You know, that your deepest friends want.
Right.
And then someone said to me, "You know, the time that I felt closest to you, Brian, is when we were out that night and I was telling you jokes, and all night you just laughed at my jokes."
Really?
And that made no sense to me at all. I was like, "What? You know, I was doing laughing. I wasn't doing anything. How is that creating intimacy in a way that I'm failing to now?" And I realized it was because I was allowing him to impact me, to affect me. You know, when you really laugh hard with someone, you're allowing them to take over your whole body in a way and shake it. Right.
Right.
So, I was like, "Oh, so the more I allow you to change me, the more intimacy you will feel." And so I just started on a mission to allow everyone to change me as much as possible.
That's interesting that you say that, because you just made me think quickly about the, I remember being a child and always having this very fortunate situation where I have a father who is a fantastic listener. And sometimes I would say even to a fault when he's with his own friends or other people, I think that he may have missed out on the opportunities to share his own opinion. But there's no doubt about it that when I was a child, there was never a safer place for me than knowing that if I had something to say, it didn't matter what time of day it was, it didn't matter what else was happening in my dad's life, he always just sat and he always listened. And that created such a beautiful intimacy between him and I, and he didn't even have to do anything. He didn't say anything. He didn't have to give me advice. He didn't have to, you know, solve my problems. He just listened.
Yeah. Yeah. And listened, by the way, the listening and allowing someone to change you are different.
Right.
I was an awesome listener. I could listen and understand and model you to a T, and you would definitely feel understood.
Okay. But were you listening with the intention, though, of finding a solution to that person's problem?
Sometimes, or sometimes just with mapping the topography. But I wasn't listening with the intent of how will this change my life? How will this interaction redirect my future?
I see. Okay. And so what shifted that for you?
Well, this one conversation with this guy named Brian Baer, a wonderful guy. And ever since then, I was like, well, I want more intimacy. I want people to feel more comfortable and more close to me. So I'm just going to do that. And so I just went on this mission to be more changeable.
Okay.
And, you know, the strangest or most ironic outcome from years of doing that is that I now have a much stronger and more solid sense of self than I've ever had. The more changeable I make myself, the more the one part of me that's not changeable, you know, my essence in a way, is plain to see. That was kind of cool. I was not expecting that as a side benefit.
That's really cool. You know, and when you're saying this to me, you're making me think about how one of the thoughts I have on life, and one of gazillions of thoughts that go through my ADHD brain every 5 seconds, but, you know, I often look at friends spending time with each other, whether it's at a restaurant or walking down the street, and I often feel that they do miss out on that intimacy, that they really do interact with each other on a level that is very surface. They ask each other the typical questions of how is work, how's the family, and then they'll repeat, of course, those questions the next time they see them a couple of weeks later. And I sometimes just want to interject with the group and say, hey, listen, I'm going to throw some questions in here, and I want you to all answer them and see how it changes the connection that you create with each other. It could be anything. It could be, you know, what do you think the greatest invention is of all time? Or if you could be invisible for one day, where would you go? And to start learning things about each other that people wouldn't normally learn and know, and then allow that as a mechanism to help them come closer. Like, your friend still on some level had to be vulnerable to say, hey, you know what, I want you to know that I've never felt closer to you than the other night when you just simply laughed at every joke that I made. Most friends don't talk to each other that way.
Yeah, it's true. Jennifer and I have a family tradition of what's called a dinner question. So if we're ever together in a group at dinner, and we do it sometimes just the two of us, we'll pose a question which is designed to, for each person who's answering it, to find out something new about themselves in the answer. So not just that I'm learning something new about you, but you're learning something new about you too. And probably my favorite dinner question of all time to date was with my mom, my dad, my son, who was 6 years old at the time, maybe seven, and Jennifer and myself. And the table question, so this is, you know, this is essentially for Jennifer, a dinner with the in-laws. You got to frame it that way.
Okay.
The question was, what's the thing you most want to emulate about each other person at the table? And what's the thing you least want to emulate about each other person at the table?
Heavy.
And everybody participated, including my son, who told my mother, you know, his grandmother, that the thing that he least wanted to emulate about her is that she's too soft on her boundaries.
He said that at that age?
The words he used were, you laugh when you say 1, 2, 3. But if I said that, you probably wouldn't know what the heck I was talking about. But what he was referring to is, you know, if you say, like, hey, you know, put on your shoes, and then you start counting 1, 2, like, if I get to 3, there's going to be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
When I would do that, I, you know, that's how I related to Spencer is, if I start counting by three, I'm going to have an issue with you. Before three, no problem, no anger, no upset. And he only got to three once, and then we had an issue. With my mother, when she would be taking care of him, she'd say 1, 2, 3, and he'd ignore it, and then she'd laugh and say 1, 2, 3 again. And she wasn't really serious about her own boundary, and he could sense that, so he wasn't therefore benefiting from her firm boundaries. And that's what he was observing. She said, yeah, you laugh when you say 1, 2, 3, and I don't want to emulate that because it means you can't help people do what they want.
My goodness, that, I mean, so many moments or emotions must have come out. Number one, I would imagine that on a certain level, as a father, you would have had a very proud moment just to know, yes, that he is so mature. And also, I'm curious, how did your mother respond to that?
Well, what ensued was a question about boundaries, and she said, I want to change that. You know, what advice do you have for me? And then all of us started to engage her in different things that she could do that would be easy for her to do that would move that in that direction. And she and Spencer, my son, made an agreement that he would help her with her boundaries.
My goodness, that is so fantastic. I love that story. You know, it's funny, when I remember one time, and I wrote about this in my book, where it was Canada Day weekend, you know, similar to your July 4th, of course, and we were all sitting around the table, and the conversation wasn't really going anywhere. And so I was a bit bored, to be honest, and I said to my family and to the table, I said, you know, I've got a question. I said, who do you guys think is the greatest Canadian to have ever lived, and why? You know, we're celebrating Canada Day. Yeah. And never thinking that I'd get much of a, you know, of an answer, nothing profound, it was just mind-blowing to go around the table and to hear things, you know, my mother talking about a famous author who was a Canadian author and how certain things she had written in her books allowed her to tap into parts of herself that she never knew existed or made her see the world differently. And then my father got into this really poignant conversation about one of our prime ministers and how he had really opened the doors for immigrants during the 60s and how much of an impact it had on him. And then to see my brothers, you know, answer the question as well was just really incredible to me. And that was, you know, one of those times where it just confirmed how incredible life can be with your partner, with your friends, with your coworkers, if you're just willing to have the guts to ask the initial question.
Yeah, totally. Questions you don't know the answer to are awesome.
That's true. It's true.
They get you back in touch with wonder, you know, which is wonder is a great place for us to connect because it eliminates hierarchy and eliminates role. It eliminates expectation. By its nature, it's something we can share, which neither of us has you know, an influence on the other, and
yes,
we can just experience it together. Yeah.
Do you get concerned as a father when you think about, you know, the way things are going with young children these days, about how they have the ease by which they can move their attention away from being curious about human beings into whatever the device happens to be, whether it's a video game? I mean, I recognize that we can still be curious about humans through the internet and we can still discover things, but do you have concerns about when you see your child and he's growing up in a world where if he wants to be diverted from curiosity, he can be?
Well, I have grave concerns about the world. I have no concerns about my child.
Okay.
He loves Minecraft. He plays Minecraft, you know, incessantly, and I'll play with him. We'll build stuff together and stuff. And we enjoy that. And so he plays his fair share of video games for sure. But he's also incredibly curious about people. And, you know, it's not media and the availability of video games and other distraction techniques that worries me about the future and our children. It's that I don't think that the average family has a powerful relationship to its own values anymore.
Mm.
And really all we can do, I think, as parents is communicate through our actions what we really value, what's really important to us, and hope that the best of those values are transferred so that they can live a life that's consistent with those same things being important to them. So if we value human life and consideration and curiosity, that they'll live a life that's, you know, filled with curiosity and valuing human life, and, you know, like so.
Okay. Yeah, I like what you're saying there. Do you think that, and like, what would you identify then as something that most parents are valuing that's not helping young children?
Well, first is I think most parents are valuing convenience for themselves, and have, you know, if you look at the rules of a household in the average family, 90% of the rules are to reduce the frustration and increase the convenience of the parents.
Okay. Can you give me an example of that?
Sure. That, you know, no talk, shut up, no talking, no, don't hit that, don't play with that, don't get this dirty, don't do, you know,
okay,
don't play with that, don't do this. There are very, very few of the rules are actually about safety or protecting property. Most of them are about, this is inconvenient for me right now, I don't feel like doing this.
Right.
And that sets up a, you're inconvenienced and I'm not, and then when you grow up, it's your turn to not be inconvenienced. Mm-hmm. And that I think sets up a very strange value system, and is part of the reason why most of the entry-level employee base is so entitled, right?
Right.
I show up to work. I've inconvenienced myself to come to work, and as a reward, you owe me money. And that mentality will not work. It's not. We won't, as a society, solve the problems that are facing, that we face, that are big problems, problems that lead to the species extinction, and we need to solve them through innovation and contribution, working together and giving everything we can and showing up and being present, not by avoiding inconvenience and entitlement.
You know, it's funny to me. I don't know if it's something that I have just noticed as I'm getting older, or it is indeed happening more. And I'm inclined to believe it's happening more with respect to this convenience of how, I don't know, maybe the word lazy people have become. I mean, I go to the gym and I'll walk into a certain area and I'll see that somebody before me was using the mat, or was using a particular weight, and they haven't even, like, it was too inconvenient for them to even just put it back, and it's only 3 feet away. Or when you see people throwing garbage on the ground, I read an article recently that said that on average a person living in a city will walk no further than 10 feet before they throw garbage on the ground. If they can't find a garbage can 10 feet, it goes on the ground. Or one of my favorite things I see more often is people who will walk up to a door, like a Starbucks, and they're going to go in. And they are fully functioning. They're healthy. They're not in a wheelchair, and yet they press the button that automatically opens the door instead of pulling the door. And I'm like, what the hell is happening to us? When did we become so absolutely lazy?
Well, I think the door thing might be different than the other two examples, because there's an inherent pleasure in operating machinery, especially for men.
So true. Yeah.
Just like getting to ride the escalator is way more fun than the stairs, just because you get to operate the machinery. But that aside, I think it's less laziness and more compartmentalization, more the imagination that if my house is clean and your house is dirty, then that's good for me and bad for you.
Right.
It actually has its root in the concept of ownership itself. If I own something and it's mine, and then I can get it, and if it's good, then my impact on the world therefore might be good, versus looking at all the ways that I've externalized harm to the environment and to you and to other people, you know, metaphorically sweeping the dirt on my porch and onto yours. If we had, if you go back to a culture pre-ownership, where we were just co-inhabiting a space, you would never sweep something off one hut and into another hut if they both were yours. It would make no sense. So the reason they're leaving plates or throwing the trash on the ground, that sidewalk isn't there, that weight isn't theirs. And it's the idea of ownership itself, I think, that creates the segregation, which allows to disconnect from the externalization of harm and cost.
You know, it's funny that you say that. And I, for those of you who are listening right now, I think that we were getting a couple of quick cutouts there on you as you were speaking. I'm not sure if it was just No, it's fine. I'm not sure if it's the internet connection. If for those who are listening, we are doing this on Skype, and we'll see if it.
Way to plug Skype, right? Yeah, if it's bad quality, just so you know, we're using Skype.
That's right. You may want to try something else, perhaps Instant Messenger if you can.
Yes.
But you know, one of the things that I've always been amazed at is when it comes to this idea of ownership, of how disconnected people seem to be with this understanding that we believe that we own, let's say, a physical space, such as a house or a plot of land, or we believe that we own a particular car, but really and truly, we almost, on some level, don't really own anything. I mean, we can say that we have the entitlement to be able to call that our house, but really, I mean, look, when it comes right down to it, if a government wanted to take that house away from us, they could change the rules and figure out a way to take it away from us. And unless it was happening on a mass scale, most people wouldn't say anything. And I believe, though, that in the whole context of ownership, we miss out on this reality, which is there isn't separation between us. We are all just one. As cliche as it may sound, as you may think that I'm listening to you too as I'm talking here, it's really something that we as a species need to recognize, that when you're driving your car down the street and you look up to the sky, don't forget to remind yourself that you're driving a car in outer space.
Yeah, right.
You know, and you're only one little bouncing ball in the midst of billions and billions of stars. And the idea of having ownership on this one planet, you owning more than the other person, is just laughable. And I think that in the process, people miss out on that ability to be able to really get the most out of life, or to come at least closer to what, I don't know, the quote-unquote meaning of life.
Which takes us back to nothing is more important than anything else, including this is mine and that is yours. And you know, the spaceship that we're all sharing, and this might be a cool ending note just as a metaphor. I saw a video recently that said the Earth does not revolve around the sun as you previously thought in the video. And I just had to watch because such a stupid claim, you know. And I thought, is this going to be some kind of like a religious rite, you know, claim on creation? Like, I just was ready for anything and wanting to be entertained by finding it foolish. But it explains simply that if you arbitrarily locate the sun as a stationary point, then yes, the Earth revolves in a circle. But it's not a stationary point. In fact, relative to the rotation of the known universe, or even this galaxy, it's going in a much, much larger circle. So the Earth is actually traveling in more of a spiral. Our spaceship is heading in a kind of a spiral direction. It's spinning, but it's also going like a corkscrew, and it's also traveling in a greater direction. And that, and in any one of our lifetimes, it would never make one complete circle of anything. And that gave me a different perspective on the inherentness, let's say, of evolution and progress, that we're always going in cycles. The way Eastern philosophy honors the seasons and honors the cyclical nature, but we're also always progressing and evolving the way Western philosophy and Western civilization honors progress. So we're doing both all the time. And keeping those together, I think, is perhaps a good way to stay grounded in the nature of reality, so that the little decisions you make, like should I do this or should I try this, or should I do the thing I've done before, or should I try a new relationship, all those little decisions, if you keep in mind what's the cycle and also how is it progressing, I think you're more likely to make better decisions that are consistent with the master plan.
Well, I always find that so interesting with respect to the decisions that people make with respect to their lives, like whether or not they're going to go for a particular type of job, or whether or not they're going to get in a particular type of relationship or live in a particular geographical area. And they're basing these decisions, in many cases, that they're influenced by what their parents did, what their grandparents did, and what their great-grandparents did. And I find it interesting because I find myself thinking, like, you do realize that your great-grandparents lived during a time when there weren't cars. And you realize that they lived during a time when the idea of communicating with someone where it didn't get written down on a piece of paper and then put on the back of a horse and then, you know, traveling for 2 or 3 months before it actually got to the person, that used to exist. And so even though that decision for them may have worked during that particular cycle of life that they were going through, it doesn't necessarily mean that that decision is going to be the most beneficial decision for you as far as bringing you to your greatest joy and to your greatest sense of meaning in this particular cycle. And yeah. I find that phenomenal. It's like I'll meet an individual. I met somebody not too long ago, and she's a doctor, and her brother's a doctor, and her sister's a doctor, and her parents are doctors. And I thought to myself, okay, that's great, but didn't any one of you as a child, like, I don't know, even once pick up a paintbrush and like it? I mean, did everybody, I mean, listen, I'm open to the idea that everybody is totally jazzed about the idea of becoming a doctor, but I still wonder on some level that, you know, whether or not these people were making decisions that were truest for themselves, as opposed to, you know, what worked so many other times for so many generations in the past. And not realizing that who we are today is not even the person we were last year. And so the decisions that we make today, it's okay for them to be different than the decisions that we made a year ago or that our parents or grandparents made hundreds of years ago. And to give yourself permission to choose differently because of it.
Exactly. You know, I think that decision is scary for many people because you can trust what works for other people, but if you're going to go based on what you think might work for yourself, on what are you trusting?
Right.
So, you know, perhaps one of the best investments that a person can make would be to invest in what would it take for them to trust in their inner voice, their inner guide, their inner decision, so that if they make a decision for themselves, it doesn't feel like they're gambling with their future or they're gambling with the lives of their children. Because there's actually a source of guidance that's more reliable than the external evidence of what's worked for other people. And all it takes is a connection with it and a trust of it.
Yeah, that's it. And do you think that are we moving as a species toward more people going with their gut and trusting that inner voice?
I think we're segregating. I think we're speciating. There's a portion of the population that is doing that profoundly, and a portion that is going further away from it. You know, just like the distribution of wealth is doing that, I think the distribution of self-reliance is also going that direction. And all one needs to do is, travel south of Egypt to witness that.
To witness the distinction between what, sorry, when you go to south of Egypt?
To witness people who are going further away from the direction of trusting in themselves.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, no, it's interesting that the big battle of what who's gonna quote unquote win. Are the individuals that are who are trusting themselves, will they through example be able to bring more individuals into that process of decision making, or will the individuals that are relying on their mental self, or the need for greed, if you want to call it that, or the short term gain, if they get that gain, will they influence more people into saying, "Oh yeah, well, I absolutely want that too"? It's like, I mean, you're an American citizen, and you obviously know all about the American dream and the idea of if you do just work hard enough, you will become president of the United States, or you will make $1 million. And we get that. Yes, there are people who've been able to prove that theory, but there isn't any shortage of individuals out there that you don't normally read about who have applied that particular mentality and gone for what they thought they're supposed to do, as opposed to listening to their gut. and they didn't achieve the American dream.
So you're basically saying that if I really work hard and stick to it, then one day I could be the greatest Canadian that ever lived?
Well, you know what? Being a great Canadian, that requires many things. Number one, you have to really learn how to be very, very polite. That's first and foremost. And secondly, I would say you definitely, whatever you do, never, ever brag about yourself.
I'm screwed on both counts.
Yeah, this is it. You don't have a flying chance of being able to be a true honorary Canadian citizen.
Well, I guess I'll just have to go back to being myself then.
Yes, well, you know what, I think that people will be glad that you made that decision, because I can tell you in this short period of time where I've had a chance to be able to get to know you, I like you being yourself. You definitely sound like an individual that I would like to be able to have future conversations with, and it would be great to have you come back on the show, because I know that we've really only scratched the surface. That's what happens, right? When you're asking each other good questions and you're willing to go into those spaces, you really do only scratch the surface of where you could go. And we haven't talked about anything really to do with what you do for a living, as far as I know that you do your own seminars. I know you do a lot of work online. Or the work that I do, and I love that. You know, it's the first thing that people usually go to when they have a conversation. What do you do for a living? Although that I do believe that that does say a lot about a person and the decisions that they've made, it doesn't necessarily have to be the go-to question. And I think that you and I have just proven that. We really haven't talked so much about our actual quote-unquote day job, and yet we've managed to, as two strangers who've come together, talk about so many other really meaningful things. And I hope that people listening to this recognize that that's available not just to two guys like yourself and myself, but to anybody. And for them to be able to understand that if they just make that effort, they can really go down some really interesting paths the way that we have today. So before I sign off with you here, though, Brian, for those who are listening and they want to learn more about you and want to kind of get into your world, what are the best ways for them to kind of track you down?
The easiest way is just at my personal website, which is brianfranklin.com. That's Bryan Franklin.com. And we've got some great resources on there. I've helped 7 companies reach $1 billion in sales or valuation for my work, and thousands of entrepreneurs make their first million. So if creating value in the world is of a big concern for you, there's tons of awesome resources there. For you, many of which are free, and go there, sign up on the mailing list, and you get a bunch of great stuff.
That's amazing. Well, I appreciate you putting that out there, and we'll make sure that we put it up onto the website as well, so that people can click on that and go to your website. Because in the short little bit that I did in kind of just finding out a bit more about who you are before we came to this conversation, I had a chance to watch some of your videos, and really and truly, for anyone who's listening out there, Brian and his wife Jennifer, they really are spot on with the communication and with the ideas that they're sharing with other people, and the ways, and then in the simple ways, if you are willing to put in that work, of being able to achieve tremendous success in any area of your life. So, Brian, thanks for taking the time and in sunny California to be willing to speak to a stranger, someone you didn't even know, and to just throw it out there. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it much, and I hope our listeners did too.
Absolutely. Well, I look forward to speaking to you soon. Enjoy whatever's coming up next for you. And until then, all the best. Big hugs to you and the family. And hopefully I'll speak to you in the very near future.
Sounds good.
Okay, take care, Brian.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is
1-800-Thank you for tuning in to The Stuart Knight Show. We hope you've enjoyed this powerful conversation. People are fascinating, and so are you. And the right questions will prove it.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. I really hope that you enjoyed my powerful conversation this week with Brian Franklin. If you are an entrepreneur who is serious about your success, check out Brian's website at www.brianfranklin.com. Franklin.com. That's BryanFranklin.com. And finally, it would mean the world to me if you just took a few seconds out of your day to share this podcast with your network. You can do that on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, wherever you show up out there in cyberspace. I really do want to engage the world in powerful conversation, and together we can make that happen. So please share it now. I look forward to connecting with all of you again next week. Until then, remember, powerful conversation, powerful life.